Okay, last time we were on this outline for chapter 3, which I didn't quite finish, and I hope you brought it back, so we'll do that. I don't know, Clyde, did we bring, or Lauren, did we bring any extra copies of chapter 3? Oh, you have it. And then there's the extra part, but the first part here was stuff you had last week. We talked last week about church and state and a right relationship. We talked about the importance of separation of powers and the rule of law, and government should serve the people. And then I said the Bible gives indirect but significant support to the idea that government should be chosen by the people. That is, there should be some kind of democracy rather than a king. And then a hereditary system where the eldest son gets to be king, and then it's all passed down by hereditary monarchy. And I think that's true. I argued for that last time, and the materials are there on the outline. But I got some objections after class. And honestly, one was in very good humor, but also very thoughtful, from Roger Hampson Taylor. And if you listen to his accent, you'll realize that he still retains some residual allegiance to Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth. So I just wanted to say, you know, what about the Queen of England or the King of Norway? I think that those aren't absolute monarchs with dictatorial powers anymore. They are largely ceremonial and exemplary in their roles. They try to act as models, role models in a way, of how everyone in the nation should act. They try to be a conscience for the nation, and they do have some power. In fact, the Queen of England still has some power, but the real ruling of the country is done by the parliament in those countries that retain monarchs that are largely ceremonial. And I suppose, Roger, we could make an argument that that's just another example of separation of powers, where some power is still reserved to this hereditary monarchy, and so it's another safeguard against government going astray. And from that standpoint, a good argument could be made for it, but having said that, it's never going to happen here. Because the founders of the United States always were trying to guard against a king under whose power they had experienced some difficulties. And then the second thing that somebody said after class, and I've forgotten who said this to me, won't Jesus rule as king at one day? And yes, he will. He will. But he'll be one who is free from sin and who rules for the good of all people and who will not be led astray by power, which tends to corrupt sinful people. And so, yes, the book of Revelation shows Jesus coming as King of Kings and Lord of Lords, and we look forward to that. And so the ultimate government of the world one day and forever will be a monarchy. I agree, but it'll be the one true monarch, the Lord Jesus. And so thank you for those corrections. Now I am at point 8 on your chapter 3 outline, way down to the bottom of page 2. Not the new outline that you got, a supplemental material, but last week's outline. Bear with me if you don't have that. We'll just hope you can follow. Number 8, government should safeguard human liberty. Here I'm going to make an argument for the importance of freedom or liberty as something that governments should protect. And you might think, oh, that's too abstract. Who cares about that? Let me tell you, it impacts you every day of your life, the kind of government you live under and whether you have freedoms in that government or not. Why do I think it's important for government to safeguard liberty? It's because, it's fundamentally, I'll just give you a summary. God values human choices. God values individual ability for human beings to make choices and make decisions about how they'll spend their time, how they'll spend their money, where they'll work, where they'll live. Those are elements of freedom. What kind of political views they'll support, what kind of church or other religious organizations they'll support or not support, those are all areas of freedom, of choice. The opposite of that system is a system of, what's the opposite of being free? Slavery. And now you start thinking, what does the Bible say about slavery? It views it in a very negative way. Slavery and oppression are always viewed negatively in the Bible, while freedom is viewed positively. So in Exodus 20, verse 2, we have God saying, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage or slavery. The people of Israel were in slavery in Egypt, and God rescued them. And he identifies himself in the Ten Commandments, in the very first sentence, as the God who rescues people from slavery. And in Deuteronomy 28 and following, God says that if the people stray from him and sin and turn from his ways, what will happen? The Lord will lead them into slavery. The Lord will strike you with madness and blindness and confusion of mind. And I'll skip a few phrases here. You shall be only oppressed and robbed continually. And so there's a... That's a curse that comes on people when they don't have freedom. In verse 33, a nation you have not known shall eat up the fruit of your ground and all of your labors. You shall be only oppressed and crushed continually. And then if we look over at the book of Judges, we find that when the people strayed from God, Judges 2, 16 to 23, the Lord raised up judges who saved them out of the hands of those who plundered them, but they went astray after other gods. And then other nations came and oppressed them and led them into slavery and bondage. And so freedom, liberty are viewed as wonderful blessings in Scripture. In fact, the year of Jubilee, which was described in Leviticus 25, was a year of liberty or freedom. And so you shall consecrate the 50th year, the year of Jubilee, and Leviticus 25:10. Proclaim liberty throughout the land to all its inhabitants. That verse from the Bible played an important role in American history. I don't know if you know. Maybe this would be a trivia quiz. Proclaim liberty throughout the land to all the inhabitants thereof is the King James Version. And that verse is inscribed. Anybody know where? Yeah, Gene? It's on the Liberty Bell. You know, you ought to go on Jeopardy or something like that. It's on the Liberty Bell at Independence Hall in Philadelphia. And it said, proclaim liberty throughout the land to all the inhabitants thereof. And that's right out of Leviticus 25:10. But the importance to the founding fathers of the United States, the importance of liberty was so great, they wanted to be free from this oppressive government that they were living under. Deuteronomy 30, verse 19, God says to people, I've set before you life and death, blessing and curse. Therefore, choose life, that you and your offspring may live. God puts before the people the opportunity to choose, and you have to have freedom if you're going to make a choice between serving God and not. Joshua 24, 15, choose this day whom you will serve. And even the gospel invitation at the end of Revelation, the Spirit and the bride say, come. And let the one who hears say, come. And let the one who is thirsty come. And let the one who desires take the water of life without price. There's an appeal to people's willingness and ability to choose. And it's from Genesis to Revelation. From Genesis, when God told them not to eat the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, to Revelation, when the Spirit and the bride say, come. There's an invitation to human choice. So liberty or freedom to choose your way of life is an exceptionally high value in the Bible. And I think God has put that desire for freedom to make choices about our life, God has put that desire deep in our hearts. And that's why that famous speech of Patrick Henry in the days leading up to the American Revolution, that famous speech became, it resonated so much in the hearts of the American people, where he said, finally, in this powerful speech, speaking as a very committed Bible-believing Christian, Patrick Henry said, "Give me liberty or give me death." That was what our hearts long for. So, if that's a high value in the Bible, human liberty, then governments should protect human liberty. And our government, in fact, was set up to protect a whole number of freedoms or elements of liberty. We have freedom of speech. We have freedom of the press. We have freedom of religion. That is, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. I don't know if I've got the exact wording, but that's freedom of religion. And we have freedom of assembly here. Nobody's going to shut the church down because the government doesn't like us here today. We have freedom to petition the government. We have freedom to be secure in our homes and persons and papers and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures. The 13th Amendment protected freedom from slavery or, what was it called? Freedom from involuntary servitude. The Constitution now protects us from being deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. So there are lots of protections of freedom built into our system of government. Now, there are always challenges to those freedoms, but they need to be protected and preserved. Have a little 2-year-old knocking on the door to get in. I think that the importance of that maybe hit home to us a little more when 6 or 7 weeks ago we had those 7 human rights lawyers from China talk here about what they had experienced. They don't have the freedoms we have. They were here, but they had to go back, and they didn't know if they'd be arrested at the airport. And they didn't know if their church would be allowed to meet next Sunday. And churches are being shut down in China now. I don't know if you've seen reports on CNN or Fox News or other things. Freedom of speech? No, not a lot. Not to criticize the government. Freedom of assembly? No. No, it's always under threat and under attack. Freedom of the press? No. I couldn't get on YouTube when I was in China. Somebody sent me, said, "Oh, look at this YouTube video." And I click on it, I click on the link, and my computer screen just goes white. Freedom of press, it's restricted. Freedom from unreasonable searches and seizures. Well, no. I mean, you've got these human rights lawyers where the police will come and actually invade their house. One of the fellows who stayed in our home, the police were there for 13 or 14 hours in his house, questioning him and his roommate. I mean, this is, it's amazing. It's amazing. And that's not just the problem in China, it's a problem in a number of countries around the world still, that there's oppression. So, and when we see the opposite of it, I think we value it. Now, do I have freedom then to drive 100 miles an hour on the 101? No. I mean, I kind of do, but not, you know, there's penalty that goes with it. So, wait a minute, government does restrict freedom somehow, doesn't it? Yes. Government does have to restrict freedom so that people don't harm one another and commit crimes. And so to fulfill the purpose of government, to praise those who do good and punish those who do evil, yes, governments have to enforce laws that bring some restrictions on freedom. People can't just go and shoot one another and kill one another without penalty. They can't rob one another. There are restrictions on evildoers. And government should place those restrictions on wrongdoing. But how much restriction on liberty is necessary? I think we always have to be on guard against government nibbling away little bits of freedom here and there, all the time, until huge amounts of life are taken away and we've lost lots of freedom. There's a And so I put here in the outline, every incremental increase in government regulation of life is also an incremental removal of some measure of human liberty. Are you feeling that a little bit? The classic book on this was written in 1944. F. A. Hayek, H-A-Y-E-K, Friedrich Hayek. He taught at the University of Freiburg in Germany, but he had to escape from his native Austria and Germany because of Hitler's rule. He came and then he was such a well-regarded economist that he taught at the University of London, he taught at the University of Chicago, and he won a Nobel Prize for economics in 1974. F.A. Hayek, The Road to Serfdom. And I read this recently in the preface. Milton Friedman, famous economist, says he keeps talking to people who have changed from believing the government should control everything to believing there should be more human freedom. And Friedman says, I always ask people what changed their minds, and they say Hayek's book, The Road to Serfdom. Hayek had seen increasing government control of all of life under Hitler as it grew, and he was fearful that it would happen. And then he went to England, and in those days, England was overcome by lots of movement towards socialism, toward government control of all of life. And Hayek said, you know the way this happens? It happens because government regulators begin to nibble away at people's freedom bit by bit. And people don't even vote to give it up. They just say, hey, we'll trust the experts on this or that. And the experts tell you what you can do, and they make more and more rules. And pretty soon you become serfs, S-E-R-F. A serf was a peasant in the Middle Ages, in these feudal farming systems where there were these great plantations or great properties, and the serfs were just peasants who worked in the agricultural area and had no freedom at all, really, just to do what the lord of the manor or the plantation told them to do. And Hayek says, government will nibble away your freedom until you all become serfs if you don't watch out. So it's The Road to Serfdom. It's a good book. Now, so we need to watch against the erosion of liberty. And I'm going to give you some little pet peeves of mine that are irritating to me. And you may say, oh, come on, Wayne, don't worry about these things so much. But I am worried about them because of the direction they are going. Plastic bags. In 2007, San Francisco prohibited grocery stores from providing plastic bags. So what, you say? Big deal. Take paper bags. The problem with paper bags is they tear, they rip. And when Margaret and I go to the grocery store, or Margaret goes to the grocery store and comes home and I carry the groceries in, I can get 6 or 8 plastic bags all at once and carry the whole load at once. But if I've got to do paper bags, I'm worried they're going to tear. They can't carry as much, so I'm going to make more trips back to the car. I don't like paper bags. And there are other things that plastic bags are better for than paper bags. Well, you say, wait a minute. How are you going to dispose of these plastic bags? Burn them up. They just burn very easily. So they do. They make almost, try it. So, but I always find another use for them. They're useful around the house. Why should government take away my freedom to have plastic bags? Because some government regulator thinks, oh, this would help the environment. You may think it's necessary. You may think it's needed. I don't. I vote against it. Okay, that's up to you. Now, second thing is, all the really fun playground equipment that I loved as a boy growing up in a small town, Jim Falls, Wisconsin, has disappeared from playgrounds around America. We used to have this merry-go-round. It was probably 8-sided. You know, it had wooden benches, and you'd run in the circle, pushing this around the circle as fast as you can, then jump on. And if you're really brave and you're a boy in elementary school and you want to show off, you climb up to the crossbars and hang off it while it's going around, and so you fall off. I banged my head really hard one time. Big deal. No more merry-go-round. Where'd they go? Some lawyers sued. Diving boards from public pools? I think they're gone. Teeter-totters? Didn't you have teeter-totters growing up? Oh, that's dangerous. How about that big high slide that you could go? And you need courage. You need balance. Need a little bit of strength. But kids got strong. And they tested their courage, and they improved their balance, and they improved their cardiovascular endurance by running around that merry-go-round and pushing it so hard and trying to outdo each other and all those fun. All you guys, somebody said, I read a Manhattan lawyer saying, playgrounds don't have any toys left that'll challenge anybody more than a four-year-old. So, okay, now that's a giving up of freedom. Why? Some government regulator. How about time spent? You know, here's one that I think is good. Time spent in security lines at airports. Why do I wear slip-on shoes now? Because Barry Asmus was laughing at me, tying my shoes all the time when we were going through these security. And he said, come on, Wayne, hurry up, Wayne. What's taking so long? Well, I've got to tie my shoes. So I bought slip-ons so I can keep up with Barry going through. Now I think that that's a small price to pay for protection from the threat of a bomb. So, okay, I'm willing to give that one up. But it's another one, and I'm saying we have to decide. Now, here's another one. Sorting of trash into various kinds of recyclable trash to be put on a separate day from other trash. Well, maybe you think that's worthwhile. I don't know. But it's a little erosion of freedom. You see what I'm saying? Nibble, 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 nibble. How about light bulbs? All of a sudden, the government has voted that after 2 or 3 years from now, 4 years from now, we can't have incandescent light bulbs. They have to be these high-efficiency bulbs. Well, we put those high-efficiency bulbs in some places in our house, but there are some places when I come in the closet and I turn on the light and I want to see what's in the closet, not wait a minute for the light bulb to warm up. There's another minute. I've got an extra minute or two with paper bags, an extra minute or two with the light bulbs in the closet. And then what size of toilet you can have and how many, what size of shower head you can have. I don't know. So some of those may be all right, some of them not. But I just want to open your eyes and say, watch, individual freedom being taken away, nibbling, nibbling, nibbling. Are we on the road to serfdom? And let me tell you, people who run small businesses, how many hours you spend filling out government paperwork and regulation in triplicate to be filed in some endless government office, I don't know. Okay, but where is the largest erosion of freedom? Taxation. Because if you take away $100 from me, then the government is saying, if I'm the IRS agent, sorry, David, I don't know, where are you? No, he's former IRS. But if I take away John Wiederquist, if I take away from John and Sandy $100, and I say, well, I'm from the government, I'm here to help you, I will show you how to spend that $100, in fact, I'll spend it for you. Now, you can't decide that you want to give it to your children, that you want to give it to the church, that you want to go out to a restaurant and eat with it, you want to put it toward saving toward a new car, buy new tires. Your freedom of $100 is taken away when the government takes that in taxes. The more taxes grow, the more your freedom is eroded. That's freedom. Okay, that's all on liberty. Government should protect it as much as they can. Are you seeing the point? It's important? Okay. Number 9. The last one in this outline. Nations should value patriotism. Nations should value patriotism. But let me tell you, I didn't know what I thought about this a year ago. I had a vague instinct that patriotism was good, but I didn't know why. So I sat down and started to work on, think about, should citizens of not just this country, but every country, have a patriotic attitude toward their country? Yes, I think so. And the basic reason for this, I think, is that God has established nations on the earth. God has established nations on the earth. Acts 17:26, God has, let me just read the verse here. God made from one man, that's Adam, every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined allotted periods and the boundaries of their dwelling place, Acts 17:26. And so the Bible talks about nations. Abraham, God says to Abraham, Genesis 12:2, I will make of you a great nation. And then Genesis 22:18, and your offspring shall all the nations of the earth be blessed. And Job 12:23, God makes nations great and he destroys them. He enlarges nations and he leads them away. Why did God establish nations on the earth? And what do I mean by nation? I mean an independent government over a relatively large group of people. There are a few exceptions like Monaco and Luxembourg. They're smaller. But a fairly large group of people ruled by an independent government that is not subject to any other government. Mexico is an independent nation, not subject to our government. Honduras just had recently in the news. That's an independent nation. Other nations tried to push it around, make it do something. No, it didn't. Honduras decided for itself. It's an independent nation. Why does God have nations on the earth rather than just one worldwide government? I think it's to protect against the horrible abuse of power that would come with one worldwide government. And when empires get very, very big, they tend toward corruption, as the Roman Empire did and other empires did. So God has a system of nations, and it's important to protect that we protect that system in the world where nations have individual sovereignty. Actually, the nations in the European Union now are just finding that they've given up some of their ability to govern themselves, their sovereignty, by committing to this European Union with all these bureaucrats in Brussels ruling over them. And they just ruled that all the Italian schools have to take crucifixes out of their classrooms. Italy. You know what the Italian Supreme Court said just this last week? No, we're not going to. So they're seeing there are threats to their sovereignty and they're pushing back against it. I'm glad. So what is the value of patriotism then? Well, it's first because we are to be subject to the governance of the nation in which we live. And I put here some verses about being subject for the Lord's sake to the emperor or to governors. They give honor to whom honor is due. Fear the Lord and the king, etc. But nations divide and disperse government power throughout the earth. And this is really important. The signers of the Declaration of Independence realized that they were doing this. They were establishing themselves as a separate nation, not under the authority of King George III anymore of England, but an independent nation. So here's how it starts out, the Declaration of Independence. When in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station. Station to which the laws of nature and nature's God entitled them. They say, we're going to become a nation like other nations. We're going to have a separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and nature's God entitle us. And so the end of the Declaration of Independence, these words are so strong, I just have to read this. Last paragraph. We therefore, as representatives of the United States of America, in General Congress assembled, appealing to the supreme judge of the world for the rectitude of our intentions, do in the name and by the authority of the good people of these colonies, we do solemnly publish and declare that these united colonies are and of right ought to be free and independent states, that they are absolved from all allegiance to the British crown, and that all political connection between them and the state of Great Britain is and ought to be totally dissolved. And for the support of this declaration, and with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. The miniseries, John Adams, reenacted this. Margaret and I watched that powerful series recently. And when those signers of the Declaration of Independence voted and put their affirmation to this declaration that they're an independent nation, this reenactment anyway, probably was historically accurate, showed there was just a solemn, sober Dead silence in the entire room. They knew that they had just signed their own death warrants because they were committing treason against Great Britain, as far as Great Britain understood it. But they were declaring that they were now an independent nation. And much as I love England, a country I love next to my own, I'm glad they did that. So we have nations on the earth. But then what does patriotism mean? Well, here are the benefits. If you support and love your country, you have, number one, a sense of belonging to a larger community of people. You're not just an independent person on the earth. You're an American, or you're a German, or you're a Frenchman, or you're a Brazilian, or a Mexican, or whatever. You have a sense of affinity or belonging to a larger community. That's good for us. And then you have gratitude for the benefits that a nation provides. So you're thankful. I'm glad I live in this country because of this and this and this. Number three, you have a sense of pride in the achievements of other fellow citizens of the same nation. I think that's good for us. You read the Olympics. How many? Are you interested in how many gold medals Brazil won? Well, if you're a Brazilian living in the United States, that's the first thing you want to find out. But if you're an American, you want to find out how many America won. Did we beat the Chinese? Did we beat the Russians? Because you have a sense of, you know, if that sprinter wins the 400-meter race, then it's in a way, well, I won because he's part of my country. Do you see what I'm saying? We have a shared sense of pride. Or you see the Nobel Prize. Oh, some Americans won. You say, oh, wow, that's great. We won. And so on with other areas of achievement. And then I think that's good. When we were in Hungary, we took a tour around the city where we were. What were they proud of? The swimmer who had competed successfully in Olympic swimming contests. And that was the Olympic, because he was from Hungary. I like that, that there's a sense of pride in the accomplishment of other people in your same nation. And then a sense of pride for the good things that a nation has done. I think that's very important because it reinforces the society doing those good things. And then number six, a sense of obligation to serve the nation and do good for it in various ways. That is, I feel an obligation to do good for the United States that's stronger than I feel an obligation to do good for Canada or for England or Germany or any other nation. Why? Because this is my country. I love this country. I will defend it. You know, 3 years ago, 4 years ago, I don't know, I was speaking to some church leaders from various countries of the world. We were in Brighton, in the south of England, a conference hall, and there's this theater, about 400 people in it. And I can't remember what the topic was, but there was a question and answer afterward in the middle of the Iraq War, and George Bush was president. And there was one question that kind of had this little snide remark criticizing America for its involvement in Iraq, and then there was another one that had this snide remark. And by the time of the third one, I said, look, I didn't come here to talk about politics. I didn't come here to talk about the Iraq War. But I want to tell you, I'm proud of my country. I'm an American. I'm thankful for my country. I'm thankful for my president. And I think we did right in going to war in Iraq. Whoa, was there silence in the room. Amazing. And then the conversation went on and other things like that. Afterward, people are milling around. People are talking. And this man comes up to me, probably in his late 50s. And he said, I'm a retired general in the British Army, and I agree with you. Thank you, sir. But I have that sense. I'm proud of my nation, and I have a sense of obligation to serve it. I mean, there's something in me that says if our nation went to war, even at age 61, would I be physically fit enough to help in combat? Because there's something in my heart that would want to defend my nation. If I had to. And I would. I'd be willing to give my life for my nation if called upon to do so. That's patriotism. I think that's healthy for a nation. And then, number seven, a sense of obligation to live by and transmit to newcomers and succeeding generations, a shared sense of moral values and standards. That is, there's something that we should be saying to our children and grandchildren. That is, when we see them acting a certain way, say, that's not the way Americans act. We work hard. We're thrifty. We defend the downtrodden and the needy. We defend freedom. We defend human rights. This is the way we act in our country. And we don't do these kinds of things. And there's something about the traditions of the country that should be passed on and shared. Now, what's the opposite of patriotism? The opposite of patriotism, now look, I'm not saying we shouldn't criticize our country. I'm going to get to that in a minute. I'm going to say, how should a modern-day citizen of Iran talk about his country? I'll talk about that in a minute. So we should be honest where there's been wrongdoing. But we shouldn't just harp on that all the time. So the opposite of patriotism is an attitude of dislike or even scorn or hatred for your nation, for your own nation. And it's accompanied by continual criticism of your country. Rather than sharing in gratitude for the benefits provided by the country and pride in the good things it has done, those opposed to patriotism will repeatedly emphasize any negative aspect of the country's actions, no matter how ancient or how minor compared to the whole of its history. They will not be proud of the nation or its history and will not be willing to sacrifice for it or serve it or protect and defend it. Those kind of anti-patriotic attitudes will continually erode the ability of a nation to function effectively and eventually will tend to undermine the very existence of the nation itself. Because how can a nation perpetuate its values if people don't like it, who live in it? How can a nation defend itself if people who live in it aren't willing to defend it or think it's worthwhile defending? Pretty soon, national sovereignty is eroded and nations don't have the ability to protect themselves or exist anymore. Now, honestly, when I started to think about what is the opposite of patriotism, I thought back to conversations in the dining hall when I was a freshman at Harvard. And that was the whole theme that was going on in so many. It was anti-American hostility. And this is 1966 to 1970. This is a long time ago. Or conversations in the dining hall as I went sophomore, junior year. And in a lot of classrooms, there was a criticism, a continual criticism of the nation has done this wrong, and it's done this wrong, and it's done this wrong. And it was just an agitation on the part of maybe just a few in the student body who came with that agenda, but that kind of poisonous attitude spreads and people don't see the need to defend the good of your nation. And I just think it's poisonous and it's harmful, but I think it just pervades a lot of university systems in the United States, the intellectual atmosphere. Now, what if your country does wrong? Well, we should be willing to criticize it, but not just focus on that all the time. So now what if you're in Iran and you want to be a patriotic citizen in Iran right now, I think you would say something like this. I love my country of Iran and its great traditions and its ideals and its history, but I'm deeply saddened by the oppressive and evil nature of the current totalitarian government. So you can say both. I love my country. I love its traditions, its great history, but I'm saddened by what's going on right now. A citizen who's patriotic in North Korea right now, horribly oppressive government, might say something similar to that. Or a citizen of Iraq under Saddam Hussein might have said, I love my nation, I love its traditions, I love its history, but I'm deeply saddened by its current ruler. That's fine. That's still patriotic, isn't it? A patriotic citizen of Germany might say, I love my nation, I'm proud of its great historical achievements in science, in literature, in music, in almost any area of human thought, and I'm deeply grieved by the evils perpetrated under the leadership of Adolf Hitler, and I'm glad that we were finally liberated from his oppressive rule. See, I think that's patriotism, too. Okay? Such patriotism will still include appreciation for the benefits a nation gives, gratitude for its good, pride in its achievements, a sense of security, a sense of obligation to serve and protect it. and transmit its ideals. Okay, I'll stop. I did liberty, I did patriotism, and I want to do disobeying government. I've got 20 minutes left, but let's take 5 minutes and see if you want to interact on those two things right now. Rose.
Okay. Since you're on this topic of erosion of liberty and the oppression that we have been feeling here in America against Christianity, with regard to this Manhattan Declaration, has there been any update or effect? And or is Scottsdale Bible doing anything to...
I don't know what Scottsdale Bible is doing. I kind of signed it and went on vacation.
I noticed.
But I would encourage everybody to sign that Manhattan Declaration. I think they've just kind of put out a general appeal, and 250,000 people have signed it. And if you Google Manhattan Declaration, you'll find I was one of the original signers of it. And it just says, you know, if the government tries to force us to go against our conscience in freedom of religion, protection of life, protection of marriage, we will disobey. And so it's taking a stand. Now, I have to warn you that some friends whom I respect have disagreed about signing it. John MacArthur and R.C. Sproul basically said, there are Catholics who sign this, and we're not pointing out where we differ with the Catholics in theology, so we shouldn't sign it. And I'm saying, hey, this is a political statement. It's not a theology statement, so so we differ on that. But if you take that into account and you want to sign it, I would encourage you to do so.
Yeah, we have signed it, but good. I just wondered what was the next step, because I then, after I signed it, I received an email which said, develop groups in your church.
Okay, good.
You know, I'm, do these
I'm for
things.
It. Thanks.
But is SBC doing anything?
I don't know. I don't know. Ask Ron. He's in charge of the class.
I don't know.
Okay. But it's a good thing to raise. And so, okay. Debbie, in the back.
To recognize Peg Cottle, whose son Jesse has paid the ultimate sacrifice for us. And would you stand up, Peggy? I don't know if you know about Jesse, but he's one of five wounded warriors who is going to receive a car that's going to be adapted to his disabilities. Can I tell him about the five
stars? Yeah, do.
The Silver Star he's going to receive. I mean,
really?
the likes of John McCain, Patton.
Is this Jesse right here?
No.
Jessie, but it's your son.
Still recovering, yes. But
wow.
I want her to talk about
Jessie. Impromptu.
You wanted me to talk about Jessie? I don't know if everyone here knows that my son Jesse is a Marine, staff sergeant. He works EOD, which is explosive ordnance disposal. Kind of the big show right now in all of the wars going on. He was deployed 3 times to Iraq, and then last February went to Afghanistan. He was deployed with his team in what's called Nowzad, a very hot area of the war. He was going to defuse a known IED and actually stepped on one that had not been found because it had no metal in it. They found how to bury the IEDs without metal in it so the detectors don't find them. Interestingly, 3 Marines had already walked that corridor. He lost both his legs above the knee. We were flown to Bethesda by the time he was able to get out of Afghanistan and then Germany. He had 6 surgeries on his legs, and thank God no infections, no other particular damage to him other than some lacerations on his eyes that have healed and some eardrums that have been perforated. One has healed, the other we're still hoping for. He has a tremendously remarkable attitude. Mm. He is very optimistic about the future. He knows that it is God that has spared his life, and very thankful to his team. He is very patriotic, as we are.
Wow.
And I appreciate your class so much, Wayne, because I do think that there's a slam against this country, and it rocks me to my soul.
Yeah.
And I think that it's high time that we, especially as Christians, stand up.
Yeah.
And we start speaking our minds, and we start saying right from wrong, and we stand up to college, universities, and the rest of them that are slamming our country. Good. And I appreciate you all for your prayers, and we just pray for ongoing prayers for him.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Anything else on protecting liberty or patriotism? Over here. I've asked your name before. Daryl. Okay, here's the microphone's coming.
When you were speaking about the incremental losses that we have when government increases itself, it reminded me of one of the main points that Jesus always confronted the Pharisees. They had done something similar, I think, by adding their traditions to the law that God had given.
Yeah. Yeah.
And therefore...
Eroding liberty, wasn't it?
And put the people in bondage,
yes. Yeah. Good point. Good point. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Well, can I do a third topic? Is it ever right to disobey government? And that's the extra handout that you got today. Let's see if we can do this. Is it ever right to disobey government? We talked earlier in Romans 13 where it said, let every person be subject to the governing authorities. There is no authority except from God. And so our general approach as Christians should be that we should obey the laws of our government. And so it should be in other countries too. That's the general approach. But are there ever times when we should disobey government? In fact, as Rose mentioned, this Manhattan Declaration that I signed, it said, if government tries to compel us to violate our conscience regarding protection of life, such as compelling a nurse to participate in an abortion against her conscience, or to violate our conscience regarding protection of marriage, such as trying to compel people to participate in a same-sex marriage ceremony, like a church, you have to allow this, or tries to compel us to violate our freedom of religion, we will not obey. So that Manhattan Declaration is actually addressing this question. And are there examples in Scripture that give us warrant for thinking there are times when we should disobey government? I'll give you a summary. I think we should obey government except when it commands us to sin against God. Okay? I think that's the general approach. Now I'm going to read a paragraph from the ESV Study Bible on civil government, which wording I find very familiar. Christians should not obey the government, however, when obedience would mean disobeying a command of God. This is indicated by a pattern showing approval of disobedience to government, in several passages. For instance, when commanded not to preach the gospel, Peter says, we must obey God rather than men. Acts 5:29. Jesus told his disciples, preach the gospel. The Sanhedrin, Jewish Sanhedrin, the ruling council of the Jewish people, said, don't preach the gospel. Direct contradiction to a command of Jesus. And Peter said, we must obey God rather than men. That's Peter the apostle, under the direction of the Holy Spirit, holding up as an example for us in the book of Acts how we should treat the command to disobey God, that we should disobey it. Another example is found in Daniel 3:13-27. Nebuchadnezzar commanded Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to worship the golden statue, but they stood firm against the king, saying, we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. And of course, they were thrown in the fiery furnace, and God rescued them in Daniel 3, I think showing that he approved of their disobedience to bow down before the golden statue. Other examples of obeying God through disobedience to civil governments include the Egyptian midwives who were commanded by Pharaoh to put to death the Hebrew children, Esther 4:16, was forbidden to come into the presence of the king apart from an invitation. She was disobeying the decree of the king. She knew she was risking her life to save her people, but she went in anyway saying, if I perish, I perish. Daniel Daniel 6:10, disobeyed the command not to pray to or ask petitions of any god or man except the king, and he did it publicly so people could see with his windows open anyway. And the wise men, who were commanded by King Herod, go and find this new baby who's been born in Bethlehem, and when you find him, come and bring me word so I too can go and worship him. That was Herod wanting to kill the king, as Jesus. And they were warned by a wise man. They were warned by an angel. And it says they departed to their own country by another way. In other words, they disobeyed the command of King Herod to come and tell him. So number two, so I think obedience to government is wrong when it would cause us to sin against God. All right? Number two, is it ever proper to attempt to overthrow existing government or to attain freedom from an existing government? How can that be right? Well, one justification that's often been used throughout history is a lower official protecting his citizens from a higher official. So here's a quote from Calvin's Institutes, and it's kind of a long quote, but it's talking about magistrates of the people. And then on the third line, it says, if these magistrates, these lower officials, if they wink at kings who violently fall upon and assault the lowly common folk, then skip down, they dishonestly betray the freedom of the people, of which they have been appointed protectors by God's guardian, and by God's providence, by God's ordinance. So he's saying that magistrates, if they wink at the kings who are assaulting these lowly people, and instead of resisting them, they're betraying the freedom of the people. And other Lutheran Reform statements approved lower officials disobeying the higher official who had become a tyrant. And so it's not wrong in general to change a government. I mean, when we vote, we sometimes vote to change a government. And one of the ways that God appoints or establishes leaders, Romans 13:2, is to work through human actions to establish leaders. So now, number three on the outline there is that there are examples in Scripture of leaders actually delivering their people from tyrants. So Moses and the Exodus, Moses delivered he rebelled against Pharaoh and led the people out from the tyranny under which they were living under Pharaoh, king of Egypt. And Judges 2:16, God raised up judges who saved them out of the hand of those who plundered them. And these judges, of course, opposed the oppressing countries. And in fact, Hebrews 11:32-34, the heroes of the faith include those who put foreign armies to flight and through faith conquered kingdoms. That's changing government. Hebrews 11, let me read the verse again, 32. Who through faith conquered kingdoms, enforced justice, became mighty in war, put foreign armies to flight. So it seems to me there's a difference between an individual person breaking the law, which Romans 13 in general prohibits, and a lower government official seeking independence from or change in a higher government. And that was the position that the American leaders of the American colonies had or thought themselves in against King George III of England. And the whole Declaration of Independence in the central section lists all these abuses. He sent armies to occupy our country. He's ravaged our coasts and burned our cities and taken away our right to enforce laws and refused assent to good laws and made us and refused to let our parliaments meet and or our assemblies, etc. All these abuses. And so they're saying, we have to protect our citizens from this tyrant who's King George trying to impose his will on us contrary to the principles of righteousness and justice. So it's a difference between an individual lawbreaker and a group of law-abiding citizens seeking to rid themselves of tyranny. I don't think Romans 13 was written about that second group. And so I think that the plots to destroy Hitler and remove him from his terrible rulership over the people of Germany, I think those were right and they were appropriate. The book of Judges in the Bible shows that God raised up some deliverers. And the Declaration of Independence reasoned that way. When a form of government becomes destructive of the end of securing life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, it's the right of the people to alter or abolish it and to establish a new government. I talked about point F, the complaints against King George. And so the signers of the Declaration of Independence and saying, we're an independent nation, they weren't just individuals. They were as representatives of the colonies. In General Assembly gathered, or something like that phrase, which I read a few minutes ago, they knew that they were leaders of those colonies, and they had a responsibility to protect the people in those colonies, just as they would protect them against individual robbers or murderers coming from somewhere or around their towns to murder or plunder them. So they had an obligation to protect their citizens from the King of England, who was sending armies to do this. So I think the Declaration of Independence and the War of Independence were justified and even necessary. And I'm thankful that that today England remains one of our closest friends in the whole world as a nation. Benjamin Franklin was part of a committee to draft a seal, Great Seal of the United States. You know, on the back of the dollar bill, we have this great seal. It's kind of a pyramid with an eye at the top, and that was the final design that was approved. But Benjamin Franklin's first draft, which wasn't accepted, but is still part of the historical record, and he described it in his own words, it had a picture of Moses. Just think about this, if this was on the back of the dollar bill. A picture of Moses looking back over the Red Sea while it closed over the armies of Pharaoh, light emanating from heaven showing divine approval, and the slogan on the motto of the Great Seal of the United States, rebellion to tyrants is obedience to God. Rebellion to tyrants is obedience to God, Benjamin Franklin. So they were, I mean, he's right at the heart of the Declaration of Independence and the founding of the nation. And I think he's reflecting a general sentiment. He was probably the least specifically Christian of those founding fathers. But even he was seeing that what they were doing was out of obedience to God, not of sin against God or rebellion. I've about 3 minutes left. If anybody wants to ask some question about that or make some comment or agreement or disagreement, you okay with this? Of course, this is of great interest to people in countries where there's oppression. Yeah, over here, Cheryl? Cheryl, one. Let's do Cheryl, and then we're going to have the PowerPoint back up, Daryl, if we could.
Good morning. So there are times when it's right for a Christian to disobey the civil government.
Yes.
But those times, we also are going to expect to reap the consequences of that disobedience, right?
Yes, we might.
That's important because we wouldn't be able to go to the judge and say, but, sir, Your Honor, this disagrees, this is against my God's law, so I had to disobey it. Therefore, don't impose this consequence on me.
Well, we could try. And in some cases it'll work, and in some cases it won't.
And is that what the Chinese lawyers are doing?
I went over this outline on Saturday morning with those Chinese lawyers, and they were intensely interested in it. Let me tell you, because it's a life and death issue for them.
Right.
Yeah, and that requires great wisdom and discernment in those situations. Yeah.
Thanks.
Okay, thanks.